Corey Rosen is the founder and senior staff member of the NCO, the National Center for Employee Ownership. He co-authored the book, Why Employee Ownership is Good for Business, published by the Harvard Business School Press in May 2005. Over the years, Corey has written and contributed to dozens of books, articles, and research papers on employee ownership. Generally, he's regarded as a leading expert on employee ownership in the world and has appeared on numerous national radio and television news programs. We're exceptionally honored to have you here joining us, Corey. How are you?
I'm great. And thank you so much, Munira, and for everybody who's listening. It's really a pleasure to do this.
Wonderful. Let's start at the very beginning, Corey. Where did you grow up? What did your parents do? I'd love to know your I guess, sort of origin story.
So I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and my mom was a bookkeeper, and my dad had a variety of jobs, ended up eventually owning a very small delicatessen. I went to college in Connecticut and got eventually a PhD in political science. And after doing that a little while, for a couple of years, I decided that was a game I'd rather play than teach. So I ended up going to Capitol Hill and working on a Senate staff. And it was there that I read about this idea of employee ownership, which was in 1978. And nobody really knew much about it then, including me. But I thought, this is an incredible idea. Here's something that Republicans and Democrats both agree on that creates greater economic justice and fairness. And that from what little we knew about it at the time, seemed actually to work, that companies would perform better. So I thought, this is a terrific idea. I was always looking for some cause to fight. And this seemed like a cause that was both something that could really make a difference, but was also practical. It wasn't tilting at windmills.
Great. So you said this was in 1978. That is amazing to know that this was a topic of focus back then. How was it described to you back then when you first heard of it?
So it first came up in the context of employees taking over a manufacturing company in central New York that otherwise would have closed. And at the time, employee ownership was being used in some cases to help save failing companies. It doesn't do that anymore, and it really shouldn't. It's really not a good approach for that. But at the time, there was some interest in that, related a lot to the growing deindustrialization of the country. But what I also found was that aside from what they were doing at this library factory in Herkimer, New York, was something called an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP, which had been passed into law in 1974, still really new. And the ESOP was something that would really be much broader in its application. It would be a way for particularly successful companies to share ownership with employees. And what was really insightful about the ESOP idea was that it was a way for employees to become owners without having to buy stock. That when a private equity company, for instance, wants to come buy a company, they typically borrow money, use that to buy the company, then pay back the loan out of the future profits that the company makes. And what Louis Kelso, who was the inventor of ESOPs, came up with was an idea that said, well, what if the employees could have access to capital credit and buy the companies they work for and pay them out of the future profits of the company? And so the trick was to get that into legislation and to provide the owners of these businesses with some tax incentives so they'd be willing to provide their collateral to allow the employees to buy stock in the company. And as it turned out, ultimately, most uses of ESOPs were to help the employees buy the stock of the owner. So again, they weren't using their own money. They were using the future profits that they would create And one of the key tax benefits was that normally when you borrow money to buy back shares, it's not a tax deduction. Mm-hmm. But if you use an ESOP to do it, it is. And that's an enormous difference in the ultimate benefit to the company and the seller.
Thank you for that explanation. Why do you think, or what could be some of the hesitations that could have led to this not being adopted more widely since then?
Well, I think it's useful to look at the history of this and understand what an ESOP actually is. And that helps people understand why there are so many of them and why there aren't more of them. So, as I said, ESOPs were created in 1974. And because it was legislatively convenient, they were added to the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA. This is the law that governs 401k plans and profit sharing and pension plans and so on. And what that law says is that the way an ESOP will work is the company sets up a trust. And that's the same kind of trust, for instance, that that a 401k plan is in, except that unlike the 401k plan, it's funded by the employer and it's designed to invest in employer stock. So the company sets up this trust and it can fund it by just contributing shares to the trust. So that dilutes the ownership of existing owners, but the employees get owners and hopefully they help the company grow. They could borrow money to buy the shares, which is the most common way that it's done. So the company borrows money to buy some or all of the shares of the company. It takes that money, buys the shares, and then the shares go into the trust and they get allocated to all the employees who work there, basically. There's some really basic requirements, but pretty much all the employees who work there. And then the shares get allocated to employees based on their relative pay. They vest over time. And then when the employees leave, they can sell them back to the company. And if you don't want to borrow money, you could just contribute cash to the plan each year and buy some shares each year. So you buy out the shares gradually. So any of those three ways. But however you do it, shares get allocated to pretty much everybody who works there, typically based on their relative pay. You can't pick and choose people. And again, subject to vesting, and then they get paid out. Now, Congress has been super generous in providing tax benefits for this. And there's three that are particularly important. The first is, as I mentioned, let's say that you're an owner of a closely held company and you're thinking, you know, it's time for me to move on. I could sell to a competitor. I could sell to private equity, but you know, I know what happens when you sell to those folks. Oftentimes they will reduce the number of people who work there. They might move the company. And if we're particularly a company with a strong social mission, they'll promise us that they'll keep that. And certainly your listeners know all too much about that. They'll promise that they'll keep that. And most of the time they won't. So if you really have a strong social mission, you want to preserve it, you need another way. So if you don't sell to another company, you don't sell to private equity, you could end up liquidating the business or trying to sell it to individual employees have to come up with their own after-tax money to buy the business, and that's really expensive. So instead, what happens, because it's tax deductible, let's say it's a $5 million business. If it weren't deductible, you'd need $8 million, pay taxes on that, have $5 million left over to actually buy the shares. With an ESOP, you only need $5 million because it's a tax deduction. So that's number one. Number two is if you sell to an ESOP and you meet certain rules, you can take the gains, reinvest them in stocks and bonds of other companies, and defer any tax until you sell those. You can't do that any other way. There's no other way to sell a business and do that. And then the third advantage is if you become or are an S corporation, the percentage of profits attributable to the ESOP are not taxable. So if you are 100% ESOP-owned company, and most are these days, then your company doesn't pay any taxes. So tremendous tax benefits. So why doesn't everybody do that? It's got legacy, it's got tax benefits, it got financing benefits, banks like it. And there's two primary reasons. One is most people don't even know they can do it. And if they go to their advisor, they're likely to say, oh, that's not a good idea, or I heard those things don't work very well, or, you know, we can get a better deal for you in some other way. And the second reason, a more legitimate reason, is that if you want to get your money, if you want to sell the whole company and you want to get your money all up front, an ESOP probably can't do that, because if you go to a bank and say, loan me enough money so the ESOP can buy the whole company, they'll say, well, we can't do that because you don't have the collateral coverage. So typically the seller agrees to get paid for part of it over time. And if the seller really doesn't want to do that, they'll look to other companies. So those are the two big reasons. But by far the biggest reason is most people don't even know you can do it.
Right. And I guess I can take a step back with you and ask you, how would employee ownership affect women, people of color, and other historically disadvantaged groups?
This is a really important question. And remember that ESOPs are a kind of retirement plan. So we know generally from extensive research that the typical participant in an ESOP company right now has about $132,000 in stock in their ESOP account. Now, the longer term employees will have quite a bit more. If you stay 20, 30 years, you'll probably have $500,000 to $1 million or more in your account. And that's for just ordinary folks, not, you know, senior executives. It's amazing what happens when you share equity broadly.
Definitely.
So that's great. Plus, these companies tend also to have 401k plans. So the employees have this secondary retirement plan. Now, let's say the company didn't have an ESOP, they had just a 401k. 50% of the private sector workforce, 50%, is in no retirement plan at all.
Wow.
So they have an account balance of zero. And people of color and women are more likely to be in that group than other demographic groups. But let's look at the group that actually is in these plans. Mm-hmm. Well, how does a 401k plan work? It works by you're putting money into the plan and the employer will match some of it. So the data show that about one third of the assets in 401k plans come from the company. The rest come from the employee. Because of this pay to play, the people who contribute the most and therefore get the highest percentage of pay contributed from the company tend to be the highest paid people. And sadly, those people tend to be overrepresented amongst white males. ESOPs are different. In ESOPs, you get, first of all, the contribution is entirely from the company. You don't pay anything. So you're in it automatically. And the rule says that you get the contribution based on a formula no less level than relative pay. And there's a cap on how much relative pay can count. So this helps people of color and women because they don't have that built-in discrimination that 401k plans do. Mm-hmm. We did a huge study with the National Longitudinal Survey. And we looked at women and people of color and single mothers and so on. We found that on every dimension, that people in those demographics did substantially better than comparable people were in companies that didn't have an ESOP. If you go to www.ownershipeconomy.org, that is a website that's devoted specifically just to that study. So it makes a big difference for the people who are most disadvantaged in accumulating long-term assets.
Oh, wow. That is very enlightening. So from speaking to you, I gather that employee ownership is a much larger part of the economy than most, myself included, would even assume. And can you give more specifics about the fuller scope of that and some examples?
Sure. So my guess is that most people even listening to this, when you say employee ownership, you think of worker co-ops. And there's maybe 800 or 900 worker co-ops employing less than 10,000 people. They get a lot of publicity, but they're not actually that common, at least not yet. ESOPs, by contrast, there are 6,500 ESOPs, and they employ about 14 million employees, and they have $1.4 trillion in assets. So that's a pretty significant chunk of the economy. In addition, there's another roughly 11 million employees who are owners in their companies through some companies who do this, who give some kind of stock grant to everybody who works there. We associate that primarily with tech firms, and appropriately so. Most of the big tech firms do give some kind of stock award to everybody, not just programmers. But Starbucks, for instance, does that. So there are other companies that do that as well. Then there's a growing movement amongst private equity firms, believe it or not, who, when they're buying companies, are saying, we want to share some of the equity with the rank and file employees. And some of these deals have now turned into companies that get sold, and the employees are ending up with a paycheck worth about 6 months to 2 years of pay. Chobani Yogurt, Chobani goes public as they had planned, the average employee there will get $500,000 from stock that they own. So there are companies doing this outside of the ESOP space, mm-hmm. but the most impactful still is the ESOP. And as I say, it's a much broader group of companies. And you can look at, if you go to the website, look for the Employee Ownership 100, you'll see the 100 largest ranked by employees, majority employee-owned companies. The biggest by far is Publix, which has 225,000 employees. Winco, another supermarket chain, 100% employee-owned, is about, 25,000 now and growing fast. W.L. Gore Associates, Gore-Tex is really the least important, or one of the least important of their products. They're now a huge multinational that is particularly active in the medical field. Seven of the largest engineering companies in the U.S., are employee-owned, and all three of the largest USAID contractors are 100% employee-owned. So there's some pretty big companies that are doing this, although the typical ESOP company has between about 20 and 500 employees. Under 20 employees, it gets pretty dicey to do an ESOP just because of legal and financing costs.
Sure, that makes sense. Maybe let's regroup a little here just to delve into capitalism, right? It gets its name because the providers of capital own and control companies. So what would you say is the difference between what we think of as capital today and what we thought of as capital perhaps a century or two ago?
And that question is at the core of our new book that I wrote with John Case called Ownership, Reinventing Companies, Capitalism, and Who Owns What. And like Robert Reich said, it was required reading for people who want to rethink capitalism. Mm. And so what we start with is, let's look at exactly that question you just asked. What do we think of as employee ownership in the 19th century? Well, it was the family that started a, you know, the textile business or the mining business or whatever. And then public companies started to come up. And public companies' ownership, people would invest in them, provide them with dollars so that they could accumulate capital to grow. That's, I think, we still think a lot that that's what ownership is. But let's look at what ownership really is today. Let's look at public companies. Public companies are either owned by individuals or institutions like mutual funds and pension funds. Individuals really aren't investing in Google. You're just betting on Google. You're buying shares in the public company because you think its stock will do well, and you're going to sell it as soon as it seems appropriate for you to sell it in terms of your investment. It's sure. really more akin to going to the racetrack and betting and placing a bet on a horse. You're no more an investor in those companies than you're an investor in that horse. And in fact, public companies don't take that money that you use to buy and sell their shares. They don't use that money to buy new capital. Something like 5% of all the capital raised by public companies to actually go, you know, purchase new equipment comes from stock sales. The rest is owned by institutions. And 60% of the institutional trades are done algorithmically. So that means computers are making the trades and typically holding the stock for nanoseconds. So that's a very peculiar kind of ownership. And neither the individual owners nor the institutional owners, with rare exceptions, is interested in trying to participate in the governance of the public company. So if you've ever owned public company stock, you get a proxy statement that says, we're having a board election, vote for 5 of 5. It's sort of like the elections in the old USSR. So it's not really an election, and you don't really have any control. And the institutional investors, for a variety of reasons, generally don't want to get involved in governance. So the CEO, what does the CEO care about? Well, the CEO cares about quarter-to-quarter earnings, not the long term. Mm-hmm. The typical CEO's tenure is less than 5 years. And if those quarter-to-quarter earnings aren't good, or sometimes even less than quarter-to-quarter, they're out of there. So the long-term doesn't matter to them. Mm-hmm. This is a very broken model of ownership. The second model is private equity, which is becoming a bigger and bigger player. About 10% of the private sector workforce works for companies owned by private equity. And their time frame's a little longer, 3 to 7 years. But their goal is to maximize profits, often by cutting workers, and then sell the company, often to another private equity firm to do the same thing. So private equity, for instance, is buying up a lot of healthcare firms and veterinarian firms and putting the emphasis not on healthcare or pet care, but on making a profit. And it's part of, for instance, in the veterinary business, that pressure is part of why so many vets are leaving, and the suicide rate amongst vets is 3 to 4 times the rate of other people. Ugh. Because of these pressures. It's not the only reason, but it's one.
Sure.
And then finally, you've got the model that we think of in private companies, which is a family or an individual owning a company. And there are lots of benefits to that. And we in no way in the book have anything against those kinds of individuals. But we point out that those businesses are going to be sold eventually. Mm-hmm. And are they going to be sold to private equity? Are they going to be sold to some big company? What are the alternatives? What would happen if instead they were sold to an ESOP? And we know what happens. We know the founder's legacy gets preserved, which mm-hmm. is really important to most founders. The community keeps that company, and now it has all these people with ownership who eventually will buy houses and buy cars. I've often thought that people should be really out there promoting ESOPs or the local car dealers. So the community benefits, and it turns out these companies perform better. We've talked about how well these work for employees, but let's look at how well they work for companies. Companies grow about 2.5% per year faster than would have been expected. And they lay people off at 1/3 to 1/5 the rate. Mm-hmm. And particularly relevant now in the so-called Great Resignation, they have much lower both voluntary turnover and layoffs. In the food sector, we just did a huge study of that. We found that voluntary turnover was 70% lower and layoffs 40% lower in ESOP companies than comparable other food companies.
Oh, that's significant. And that correlation, obviously, there's a reason.
These companies, one of the things about employee ownership companies, they value employees.
Right.
So they know, and the data actually bear this out, they know that when there's a downturn, most companies will lay people off to maintain their profits, then have to hire people back if they somehow manage to start making profit again. That's very costly, and you're going to lose business. ESOP companies say the last thing we will do is lay people off.
Right.
Because if and when things get better, we're going to be ready to roll. And they are, and they do better.
I also wanted to ask you, so early in your career, you worked on Capitol Hill, and you also helped initiate and draft legislation on ESOPs and employee ownership. Could you discuss that a bit?
This is an interesting experience. I worked on Capitol Hill for 5 years, and 2.5 of those years worked on employee ownership. And one of the things that was so striking about it was that we think of legislation as something that you get some political interest with a lot of clout, you know, the NRA or whatever,
right,
that goes and persuades members of Congress to do something. Obviously, that happens a lot. Employee ownership had no lobbying behind it. It had no PAC. It had no anything. It didn't have people voting, you know, and it's still the case that no member of Congress gets elected or unelected because of their stance on employee ownership. So it had to sell itself as an idea, simply as an idea. So for instance, when we were bailing out Chrysler,
right,
my counterpart on the House side, a staff person who's still involved in employee ownership as well, we said, well, you know, we shouldn't just bail out Chrysler without the workers benefiting. Let's require that part of the ownership go to an ESOP. And so we went to our bosses, and well, that's a good idea. And it became law. It didn't really have a lot of opposition. The opposition it had was from Chrysler and Lee Iacocca, who was the incoming chair there, who, you know, really thought this was a terrible idea. But by the time he realized that we were serious about this, it was too late. Interestingly, when he wrote his biography, it had been successful. And so he said it was his idea. Then,
of course,
one of the more significant bills was somebody came to me, owned a small company, was going to sell to an ESOP. And he said, you know, if I sell to John Deere, I could sell to John Deere, and they wanted to buy him. I could sell to John Deere, get John Deere stock, and I wouldn't have to pay any tax until I sold that stock. If I sell to an ESOP, and I'm going to do that regardless, if I sell to an ESOP, then I'm going to have to pay capital gains tax. And that doesn't seem right. So I agreed. I went to my boss, who was the founder of Earth Day, and one of two people to vote against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, Gaylord Nelson. And I said, Senator Nelson, this seems like a great idea. What do you think? And he said, well, it seems like socialism to me. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, Senator, I've already talked to Senator Goldwater's office. We're going back a ways. Senator Barry Goldwater was arguably the founder of modern conservatism. And I said, well, Senator Goldwater's office already has endorsed this idea. And he said, okay, great. Let's go with it. He wasn't
objecting. Was that true?
He wasn't objecting to the idea that, you know, in his view, this sort of sounded socialistic, which it's not. He just didn't want to be seen that way. And now he had cover. And this same pattern repeated itself over and over. There's 17 different laws that have been passed to encourage employee ownership. They keep layering more tax benefits on it. And each time it's been supported by the most disparate groups. So, for instance, right now there's a very important piece of legislation called the WORK Act, which is part of the retirement reform bills, likely to pass. And the WORK Act would provide states with money to do outreach programs to educate people about employee ownership, all forms of employee ownership. The sponsor of that is Bernie Sanders. One of the other people who've supported this sort of thing is Ron Johnson. Mm-hmm. I don't think there are two people more politically disparate than that.
Sure.
Virtually, California just passed an employee ownership bill, creating an employee ownership office in the state.
Right.
Passed both houses without opposition.
Great.
So that's this peculiar nature of it, that Republicans and Democrats both find something in it that they really like. The good news on that is that it is that bipartisan, easy to pass bills. The bad news is that employee ownership gets a pat on the head. Mm-hmm. And people move on. There's almost nobody, because you would have heard them, who says, right, you know, employee ownership is really an important idea. And we need to talk about it. We need to take the final steps that are needed to make this more common. And it should be a priority. No politician has ever done that. Maybe Bernie Sanders comes close, but no politician really has ever done it. And no pundit talks about it that way. And it's really peculiar and discouraging. We're talking right now a lot about unionization.
Right.
That's great. I'm in favor of that. But employee ownership is vastly larger than that. The number of companies that might become unionized is a tiny fraction of the number of ESOPs. But we don't talk about that.
And we should.
We should.
Absolutely. You mentioned SB 1407 in California, which ASBN we actually supported. We have a Transforming Business Ownership Project Subcommittee.
That.
Yeah. I'm sure you know Babby Jacobs, Hillary Abel from Project Equity, and they're doing excellent work leading that with us. So, you know, that's great to hear about. We are hopeful that this can be adopted to other states. And as you had also, you know, kind of touched on, there has been support from both the conservative Republicans, like who you mentioned as the founder, right, of modern conservatism, as well as the most progressive Democrats. And why do you think that is? And lastly, I guess we could end on, what do you think needs to be done to move this idea forward further?
Well, part of why you have this support, it seems kind of an anachronism in American politics these days, but it's true. Part of why you have this support is the data actually show it works. So we have all these studies for now decades showing it works for companies, works for communities, and works for employees in fairly dramatic ways. So it's hard to say it's a dumb idea, because nobody loses and a lot of people win.
Right.
The second thing is, from the conservative point of view, you know, I did a podcast last week with a religious, ultra-conservative group somewhat similar to yours, but they're just focused on podcasting and their TV network. They liked it. And what these people like is that it's more capitalist. It's making capitalism more robust, and they're all in favor of capitalism. From the liberal standpoint, it's making capitalism more fair. So both sides see something in it that they can agree on, and it works. So you know, to your question, what can people listening to this do to make this more widespread? Well, I'd say that the most direct thing you can do, for, aside from talking about it, and maybe if it fits for your company doing it, the most direct thing you can do is do what Michael Brownrigg, who heads a new private equity firm called Apis and Heritage, that's buying firms that employ lots of minority workers and then turning them into ESOPs. Michael was a friend of Senator Josh Becker. in California. Not a close friend, but a friend. And he called him up and he said, hey, you know, Josh, this employee ownership's a really interesting idea. And Senator Becker said, yeah, that is actually a good idea, Michael. What do we do? And Michael said, well, I'm going to put you in touch with these folks and your staff can work with them. And that included, you know, people from your group, from a variety of other groups, from us. We formed a coalition and we had conversations with his staff and wrote this bill, and it passed. So that can be replicated. Contact a state legislator you know, or just the one who represents you, and say, hey, this is a really interesting idea. Colorado's done this. Massachusetts has done it. California's done it. Pennsylvania is likely to do it. And so is Tennessee. Why can't we do it? Let's do that in our state.
Right.
There's models of legislation to follow. We can provide those to people. You get credit for passing a bill and you do a good thing.
Thank you so much, Corey. So much we could talk further about, but I think we are at time. Maybe we'll do a part two at some point. But thank you again for your time. It was wonderful to connect with you, learn more about NCEO. How can our listeners be in touch with yourself or with NCEO? Is there a social media you'd like to plug or anything?
Sure. So the best way is just to go to our website, which is nceo.org, just our initials for National Center for Employee Ownership, or just Google that. And you can see our contact information there in the About Us section. Feel free to email me. My email address is crosen@nceo.org, crosen@nceo.org. It's easy to find it on our website, though. And so we really welcome questions. I'd love to get people contacting me with follow-up or questions. I love to answer questions on this. It's my passion in life.
You seem to have so many answers, so that doesn't surprise me at all.
And the new book is available on our website. It's also available as of September 13th in Kindle and audio and print on Amazon and other sites. So it's Ownership, Reinventing Companies, Capitalism, and Who Owns What.
Very exciting. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate it, Mandira. And I really appreciate the great work that your organization is doing. It's really important.